today, this morning, George was telling me about a pipeline that they're going to possibly run through Vermont of tar sand oil. That's a new truth. I could take that new truth and say, oh, that's horrible, and walk away and leave it. Or if I let that sink into my being and integrate it within who I am, it may call me to some kind of action. And I think that is the hope in the heart of the free mind, is that when new truths come in, we don't just put them aside as a possession or something over here. We can bring them within ourselves, and that they would call us to some form of action. And if you read more of Channing's work, you will get the idea that he is, against is not the right word, I'm not sure the right word, but when it comes to passivity, he is hard against that, that we are not to be passive beings, but as Unitarian Universalists, we are to be human beings of action. The last time I was here, and this is the second part of a three-part sermon, and the last time I was here, I talked from the words of William Ellery Channing, where he taught that we have a capacity within ourselves to reflect on ourselves and to develop our own nature and develop our own identity, and we are not to be coerced by the external world. In a sense, we are not to take truths from history and impose them upon ourselves and conform to them. That again, we are to be open to the truth. So we have that self-searching power and self-forming power, which he calls spiritual freedom. So that when we are spiritually free, we are engaged in a process of self-reflection and self-forming. Today, I'd like to focus on two thoughts, one from William Ellery Channing and one from Christopher Bolas, a psychoanalytical thinker of today. And what William Ellery Channing is saying is that we are to increase that space in which our free mind can be active. We are to actively push out and create space. And I'll read a quote about civil liberties in the Bill of Rights that he talks about. What Christopher Bolas is talking about, we'll get to it in the second half of the sermon, he's talking about how that space where we can have that free mind and exercise that free mind, how that space collapses. So we have two thinkers, one telling us to create the space, and another one saying, be careful because that space can collapse. And he talks about that. This is a quote from William Ellery Channing's work called Spiritual Freedom. I now proceed, as I propose, to show that civil or political liberty is of little worth, but as it springs from and expresses and invigorates this spiritual freedom, this self-formation capacity. I account civil liberty as the chief good of state. He's saying that the chief good of state is to honor the Bill of Rights, civil liberty, in such a way that it invigorates our mind and nurtures spiritual freedom and self-formation. This is what the governing forces, according to Channing, this is what the governing forces of our nation ought to be about foremost, the well-being of the citizens. I account civil liberty as the chief good of state because it accords with and ministers to energy and elevation of the mind. Liberty, which does not minister to action and the growth of power, is only a name and no better than slavery. We may learn that the chief good and the most precious fruit of civil liberty is spiritual freedom, that self-formation, and power by considering the chief evil of tyranny. I just want to compare it and contrast. Now, at this time in history, As I learned talking to Fred and Laurie at the Stratford Church, that churches were beginning to split and cause differences in the 1830s and would go out and start building their own church because they couldn't, I think that they said, they couldn't agree on which time they should meet in the town hall, so they didn't go out and build their own church. And so one group would go out to build its own church, and during the day they would build it, and at night the other group would come down and take down what the other group put up. Now, think about that. going on at the time religiously. It was beginning to fracture. It was also the same time that the elite in America were talking about bringing the nature of the Prussian school system into our country. And the Prussian school system was to conform people so they'd be obedient to the king. And so in the history they were talking about that. So that's also going on in Channing's time when he's writing this. Another thing that was going on in Channing's time, if I remember correctly, isn't during the 1830s when Andrew Jackson pulled the charter of the Bank of America because it was too influential in politics? I think that's correct, that he did do that. The bank was getting too strong and he pulled that charter. So this is the environment in which Channing is writing. So when he says the tyranny, the chief evil of tyranny, he's comparing spiritual freedom. He's just not doing that as an intellectual effort. He's talking about what's happening for him in the here and now and what's going on. I know that tyranny, does evil by invading men's outward interests. Okay. So tyranny comes in and invades our outward interests. I guess we internalize it and become congruent with the outward interests at the expense of our own self-development. By making property and life insecure, is that a fear-based government? Mm-hmm. When we get insecure about our lives, we get insecure about our property, we get insecure about our pensions, we get insecure about our 401k, I mean, we get insecure, we live in fear. By robbing the laborer to pamper the noble king, I was looking at a chart the other day, and it was about different countries, and it had how much the worker gets and how much the CEO gets in various countries. And it went from $1 to $13, and I think in the 60s in this country it was $1 to $7, I'm not sure. $1 to $13, then $1 to $16, $1 to $17, and then the second to the highest was $1 to $50. The highest was 475 to 1. That was our country. So Channing's saying, by robbing the laborer to pamper the noble and king. But that's not its worst influence. Its chief curse is this, that it breaks and tames the spirit, sinks the person in their own eyes, takes away vigor of thought and action, and substitutes for a conscience of outward rule, makes him abject, cowardly, a parasite, and a cringing slave. Now, when I first read that years ago, I kind of just went right over it and continued on. You know, you're trying to read fast, get things done. But in the past 6 months, I was reviewing that and reading that again, and I'm going, this is pretty harsh. These are harsh words. That when we give up that process of self-reflection and self-formation, when we abandon that as a spiritual way of life, we become vulnerable to internalize the external values without an internal dialogue to see if we really like them or not, and according to Channing, become a cringing slave. Now, this is at a time when the slavery fight was getting intense, 1830s, 1840s, so the use of the word slavery, I would imagine, had some power, maybe more so than today. This is the curse of tyranny. It wars with the soul, and thus it wars with God. Here we see the chief curse of tyranny, that it should teach us that the civil freedom is a blessing, chiefly as it reverences the human soul and ministers to growth and power. So what Channing is doing is he is relating what goes on in our inner world to what goes on with the governing forces. He's saying there's a relationship between the two. And that relationship can be one that invigorates the mind, that matures us as human beings, and moves us in creating a culture of what I would think would be kindness and well-being. Or the governing forces can relate to us in an act of tyranny, which reduces us to a cringing slave. Have you ever seen that? The Venn diagram, where you have three circles. Say like you would have an individual and then another group, and then you have a circle in the middle that encompasses both. And in a way, that's a model that we could apply to Chan. You have the individual, you have this circle that includes stuff of who you are, and the space in between, and that circle would be the space in between, then you have the governing forces. And that middle circle encompasses both the individual and the governing forces, and there's a flow, and there's a movement to where that the voice of both, the voice of the governing forces, and the voice of the individual, come out and they meet in the middle, and there's a dialogue about how to relate to one another and how to be with one another. And he's saying in that dialogue is where we find the spiritual freedom and the enlightenment and the invigorating of our mind to maturity. When he says that's not there in that Venn diagram, the voice only goes one way. Goes from the governing forces through the space in between into the individual, and that's it. The voice of the individual or the local community does not get out in the process of conversation of deciding how the structure is going to be. In a way, Channing, if we were to put it in psychological terms today, Channing's talking about creating an environment where the individuals, the local communities, the schools, the churches, and the governing forces work so that people can have a sense of psychosocial integration. Psychosocial integration is a profound interdependence between the individual and society that normally grows and develops throughout each person's lifespan. When you bring in the Prussian school system, you don't have psychosocial integration. You have the same thing. You have information and a way to be moving in one direction, and there's no dialogue. So Channing's struggling not just against churches restricting that spiritual freedom, but also a society that appears to be moving in that direction. And you can tell this when you look at his writing, The Great End of Religious Instruction. He says, religious instruction is not to stamp our minds upon the young, but it's to stir them up. Not just the young, but here today. Stir them up. To stir up our minds, to question what's going on, to find out why that pipeline's there and I never knew about it in the first place. And how did that happen? Not to make them see with our eyes, but to look inquiringly and steadily with their own. Not to give them a definite amount of knowledge, not to say this is the knowledge you need to function in society, and this is the knowledge you get, and that's all. As to go back to Channing's other words, not accepting any new knowledge, you only get this block of knowledge in order to function society, but to inspire a fervent love of truth. And he goes on. So Channing is fighting for that space. Now Christopher Bolas, writing in the 1990s, he writes an article called The Fascist State. And he asks the question, how do we move, as in Germany and other countries, how do we move from a seemingly liberal parliamentary process, a state, a nation, from that to a fascist state where millions of people support this fascist idea? And as Channing describes what happens to that individual, we're going to see a relationship between the individual and the fascist state. But before we go there, I thought it was helpful to me to review. I don't know if any of you have read Dr. Lawrence Britt's work. He looked at the regime in Italy and in Germany and in Spain and in Indonesia, where they were fascist states, and he said, what's common in these fascist states? You know, what makes them a fascist state? What's common? So he found 14 traits, and I added one of my own, which I'm not to do. Okay. And these 14 quickly are a powerful and continuing nationalism, disdain and recognition for human rights, and disdain for the recognition of human rights, identification of enemies and scapegoats as a unifying cause. That's a great one. I mean, does that work or does it not work? Just find somebody, an enemy. In personal relationships, I call it negative bonding. And what I mean by that is if I'm sitting around the table, if I go home and sit around the table with my whole family, call the extended family, sooner or later somebody's going to throw up a negative idea or a negative object or a comment about a person or a group of people that's negative. And so then the whole family is going to start talking about that. It's negative bonding. I've got to watch that because that's my family system. I bring it with me. So I'm glad I'm aware of it. But sometimes you'll get in groups that's the only way they can bond. There's no intimacy. There's no real joy in the space in between. It's always about something negative. And that's what this is about when you have this scapegoating process. Supremacy of the military over the domestic, particularly in spending, rampant sexism, traditional gender roles are made more rigid, control of mass media, obsession with national security, religion and government are intertwined, corporate power is protected, labor power is suppressed, disdain for intellectuals and the arts, obsession of crime with crime and punishment, rampant cronyism and corruption, fraudulent elections. And the 15th, the one I'm going to add, is that compassion and nurturing are surrendered to indoctrination. And indoctrination becomes more important than the relational stuff and nurturing people. So Bowles asked the question, how does this happen? How do we do that? How does a country end up with these 14 characteristics that seem to be supreme over others, and these become the guiding principles? Now, when Channing says that the soul, and there's a warring with God in this process, when Channing says that, I think, okay, what does that mean? What does that look like in the individual? That means that we have a sense of dis-ease within ourselves. We have an inner conflict within ourselves. Now, the free and the parliamentary mind is a mind that has its own legislative process. If I've got this dis-ease inside myself, I think, man, I got to do something about that. What's that from? Where is that from? And if necessary, I'm going to make an appointment with the counselor. I'm going to make an appointment with the minister. I'm going to go find out what this anxiety, what this depression, or what this grind inside me is, because I want to resolve that and get on with my life. In the fascist state of mind, or the mind under tyranny, you don't do that. You repress it and put it in the box and push it away and move on with your life. But as most of us know, when we repress that kind of inner conflict and box it up and say it's part of our history, that it springs out in different ways. It manifests itself in different ways. So that's the problem. And one of the most more horrific examples of what Channing is talking about, what Bowles is talking about, gives this example of an SS officer to his top commanders. He says, most of us know what it means when we have 100 corpses lying here, 500 here, 1,000 here, and we all have gone through that and seeing that. And he says, apart from a few exceptions of human weakness, what makes us strong is we can see that and we remain a decent people. So how is it that the human capacity of nation and individual can take the qualities of compassion, of kindness, of a movement toward well-being, and as a new term I learned since I'm gardening in Vermont, of hard plating, I've learned this word that we have to dig with the shovel rather than rototiller because you hard plate the dirt and the roots can't get through. And I thought, well, maybe that's what happens to our imagination. When we get the external forces just processing continuously at us, that there's a hard plate that gets created in our imaginative process, and behind that hard plate goes our compassion, our nurturing, our sense of well-being for ourselves and others, and we live our lives on this side of that hard plate, and that's how we can say, well, we have to sacrifice some whales and dolphins, well, we have to sacrifice this part of nature to live the way we want to live. We can see course, is over there. We have to do that because I'm not in touch with that part of me that would say, no, we're not going to do it that way. We're going to do it another way. So Bowles says there are 8 stages that create this process. He lists them. It's great. I mean, well, it's not great. It's horrible because when you hear the 8 stages, you're going to go, oh my God, where are we living? Okay. These 8 stages where you move from a caring, a free mind, a mind that's developing itself, developing its own identity, engaging in that lifelong process of development, to a mind that stops, to a mind that frees. He says there are 8 stages. The first of these stages is distortion of what's going on. So, political process, somebody offers up a bill, somebody says something about the bill that's really irrelevant to the bill, but knowing that whatever they say would create a storm against the bill, even though it's not what the bill says. Distortion. Or somebody might say something negative about this church or that church, or like with Unitarian Universalists, I've heard, oh, you don't believe anything. You don't have any beliefs. You know, and I'm thinking, well, no, that's not true at all. We have lots of beliefs. Okay? The second one is decontextualization, where you take an event and you say something else, such as when 9/11 happened, it was said, this is our Pearl Harbor. This is Pearl Harbor. So what you do with the decontextualization is you go to another context, you take beliefs, feelings, ideas about that other context, and you bring it in, and you interpret the here and now context from this context, which distorts what happened. It's a wonderful technique for distraction. Oh, you used to do that 10 years ago, and you're still doing it. None of us have said that to our partner. But that's what that is. It fails, it creates a system where you cannot possibly truly understand the depths of what's going on in the here and now when you take a historical event and impose it upon it. Decontextualization. So that's distortion, decontextualization. Denigration, where you belittle people, you shame people. What I noticed about most of these characteristics, they're shame-based. They're not life-affirming. They're not nurturing the well-being of the person, but they are put down. Denigration, where you belittle the person. Caricatures of persons, just turn Saturday Night Live on, I guess, or listen to other comedians, and you'll see this caricature. Sometimes we might not get the right president because of the caricature. We'll believe the cartoon rather than character assassination. You just look for something negative in the person, and you just drill that, and you assassinate their character. Change the name. When you change the name, what you do is you give yourself permission to relate to that person as an object. That person is no longer a person. That person is no longer a human being. That person is this, or that person is that. And I'm not relating to a person. I'm relating to a that. I'm relating to a this. And if you've ever been called a name, or you ever get called a name, raise your red flag, because you know you have been objectified, and what's going on inside you is not really available for that relationship at that moment in time. It's just not there. For example, you're in an argument with somebody you care about, right? You say in your mind, well, I don't want to say that because that would be very hurtful. Or you might say, no, I don't want to say that because I'll be paying for that for 10 years. So you know not to say these things that could be hurtful, right? And so, but the argument gets intense. The argument gets so intense that the part of you that is that arbiter, that part of you that would say, no, you don't want to say that, collapses and disappears. Then you say things you really don't want to say. It doesn't matter whether they're true or not, because the emotional aspect is what you're trying to give to that other person. Okay. Then later on, you come back and you revise yourself, and you say, oh, man, I shouldn't have said that. I'm sorry. What do I need to do? Is there anything I do? And you start to reconcile, right? You start a reconciliation process. right? And most of us have gone through that. But with the fascist state of mind, the loss of that observer, that observing eye, the conscious, the loss of that becomes permanent. There is no apologizing. There is no reconciliation. There's just our way. Talking to my cousin, we have great conversations because we are on opposite ends. You know, and we're talking, and all of a sudden I hear this, no compromise! And I'm going, he's talking about health care. And I'm going, what do you mean no compromise? Well, let's look at who's going to be helped, who's not going to be helped, and how this might work. No compromise. That's it. There's no internal dialogue. There's a stance, and that's it. Maybe there's a time and place for that, but as we're working on the well-being of the nation, I don't think so. Going back to that decontextualization, I don't know if you've read the work of William Irwin Thompson. He makes the statement that our entertainment world and the facts and truths about our entertainment world, that's a paradox, the facts and truths about our entertainment world, is becoming our history. You will begin to mark history through entertaining events rather than history. So 1965, the Baltimore Colts lost. 1969, the Baltimore Colts lost to the Jets. 1969, the Baltimore Orioles lost to the Mets. 1969, the Baltimore Bullets lost to the New York Knicks. I mean, that's a serious wound in my psyche, but that's how I remember 1969. Entertainment events. When Star Wars comes out, when the movies come out, are they going to do a prequel? Are they going to do this? And so I'm reading and I'm taking in information about the movie world. When's the next Lord of the Rings coming out? And I become filled up with that. And that's what William Irwin Thompson is saying, is that that is becoming our history, and that is how I begin to interpret the world. Not, you know, we had a president who pulled the charter of a bank. What was that about? Not, what is William Ellery Channing talking about? Mostly I think he's a good guy, and he's using some pretty harsh words. Why would he be using those harsh words? And then digging into the history to find out why that came about. Why don't we know about that pipe? Why, you know, digging into the history so that our history is history, not entertainment. And conclusion, the next one is character assassination, change of name, categorization as an aggregation. He's just a liberal, he's just a conservative, that's how men think, that's how women think. You take the individual, you take, especially if they're saying something you don't like, you take their voice, and rather than engage the voice that you hear, rather than let that voice come into you and say, what does that mean, what is that about? And ponder about that. Well, I think this way, but maybe that point, you know, maybe I need to think about it. Maybe I'm not right. You know, why would my cousin say no compromise? What's going on with him? And have that dialogue. You're all the same. So I'm not listening to any of them. That's when you lump people into the group. And then finally, the last one, after these first seven stages have done their work, finally, we have the absence of reference. The idea, the person, or the group is never mentioned again. They're just gone. So what would it be like today if I had a national platform and I said, hi, my name is Gregory Wilson and I'm a Christian socialist running for president? I wouldn't get very far. When's the last time you heard the phrase Christian socialist? Yeah? Pre-World War I, pre-World War II, the social gospel across denominations, that was a powerful movement. We might say that some of the Franklin Delano Roosevelt's policies, Social Security and such, we might say that they were a movement out of that Christian socialist movement, or the social gospel movement. But after World War II, you can't even say the S word in Florida. Bernie Sanders, he's listed as independent. Where I see the news, words you can't even say. Channing and we have Bolus, and we look at those. And I'm thinking, as Unitarian Universalists, we're going to put that coat on. We're going to put those clothes on. Unitarian Universalists, and we're going to wear them. And we're going to claim that. And we have a duty to our faith ancestors. We have an obligation to the here and now to speak the truth as we know it and to know the history and to speak it. We are called to do that in our spiritual lives. It will lead to create an environment where we can self-reflect and do that self-culture, self-transformation, speak the truth from there. We are not to be passive about that. That is who we are. That is in our roots. And we need to show the